everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Katie Helper Show. I am so thrilled to be here because, as always, if I do say so myself, we have a great show for you today. I'm not praising myself. I'm praising our wonderful guests. I'm so excited. We're going to be talking to a bunch of people. We're going to be talking to Medea Benjamin about getting roughed up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. We're going to be talking to her about how she recently was arrested for interrupting Lloyd Austin. We're going to be talking to journalist and activist Bryce Green, who was just arrested at Indiana University. We're also going to be talking to Aiden Khamis, who was also arrested at Indiana University at the student encampment for Gaza. But first, we're going to speak to two filmmakers. Now, before I bring them on, make sure you like the stream. Make sure you give it a thumbs up. Make sure you subscribe. Every time you subscribe, a piece of Hasbara dies. That's what I just made up. That's my rule, and I'm sticking to it. And I'm probably going to be accused of hate speech now, but that's okay. Hasbara is not a person. It's a thing. It's propaganda. So yeah, subscribe, like, if you can support on Patreon, we couldn't do the show without you. And you can do that at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. For $5 a month, you get all sorts of bonus content. For just $1 a month, you make this show happen. I'm going to bring on our first two guests. I'm very, very, very excited to be bringing these two people on. They are co-directors of a great documentary, a documentary with a science fiction twist, if you will. It's called Lid. And those two filmmakers are Rami Younes and Sarah Emma Friedlander. Rami Younes is a Palestinian filmmaker, writer, journalist, and activist from Lid. He's written for the online magazine 972 and served as both writer and editor of its Hebrew sister site, Local Call, a journalistic project he co-founded designed to challenge Israeli mainstream journalism outlets. Rami served as a parliamentary consultant and media spokesperson for Palestinian member of Knesset, Hanin Zoabi. Rami is also co-founder and manager of the first ever Palestine Music Expo, an event that connects the local Palestinian music scene to the worldwide industry. Younes is the host of the Arabic language daily news show On the Other Hand. And Sarah Emma Friedland is a New York City-based media artist and educator. Her work has screened at institutions including Cannes Film Festival, Lincoln Center, Anthology Film Archives, PBS. Her work has been supported by grants and fellowships, including the Jerome Foundation, the Palestine American Research Center, and the McDowell Colony. Named one of the top 10 independent filmmakers to watch by Independent Magazine, she is a recipient of the Paul Robeson Award from the Newark Museum and was nominated for a New York Emmy. Friedland is a member of the Meerkat Media Collective and the director of the MDOCS Storytellers Institute at Skidmore College, where she is also a teaching professor. So, welcome, Rami and Sarah.
Hey, how's it going?
So good to be here, Katie.
Thanks for coming. So let's start off by playing a trailer of your film, Lid, which is a documentary, but also has elements of science fiction, and we'll get into why that is. But basically, just to set it up, the way the film works is that it shows what Lid is like in reality and what Lid could have been like had the Nakba not happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair? Okay, good.
That's fair.
Let's take a look at this trailer for Lid.
This tree has lemons, oranges, and grenades. Every day they would throw something at us, and we kept it as a reminder of what we went through. I don't want to go through a second Nakba.
I am thousands of years old. Everything changes. I'm not saying I want to be a utopia, a perfect city. I just want my exiled sons and daughters back. I want to prosper again. The story of Lid is the story of Palestine.
So, tell us about why you chose this as a focus of a documentary. What made you focus on a city that used to be Palestinian, is still Palestinian, right? But is technically Israeli. I don't want to even how I describe that is charged. So tell us what made you focus on this city.
You start.
So I'm Jewish American, and I had never heard anything about the Nakba. And in 2015, I read an article about what happened in Lid, and it totally blew my mind. I had never, you know, I'd never known this information. The article itself does not go far enough, but it definitely got me kind of in it. And so I decided, you know, I can use my storytelling skills to, you know, try to use film to make this more widely accessible. And so through a friend, I met Rami. Rami is from Lid, and we started working together on this.
So, first off, I want to say thank you for trying to kill the Hasbara. they're probably going to make you anti-Semitic for doing that, even though Hasbara is not a person. Yeah, so, well, anyway, so Sarah contacted me. We started working on this film, and we wanted to tell the story. And even though the story of the Nakba is a story that's been told many times in the past, the specific story of Lid, or in Palestinian cinema, a specific story of a city has not been told. So we decided to tell that story. And why include science fiction elements? Because, I mean, how do you tell a story of expulsion and ethnic cleansing that's been told many times in the past, and try to draw new crowd, new people to it, and get people's interest? So we figured, okay, let's figure. Maybe we need to think outside the box, and maybe if we imagine this place without the occupation, without the atrocities that happened in 1948, let's see what we can come up with. So we decided to weave in like two realities throughout the film. And one more interesting science fiction element, which you just showed in a trailer. You also gave a shout out to Democracy Now. So that was very cool.
Yeah, because they did the voiceover. So I just stole theirs. Yeah.
That was awesome. So speaking of voiceover, in our film, The City Speaks, we gave a voice to the city. We Palestinians, we have to keep telling the world that we have to keep reminding the world that we are human beings as well. For some weird reason, we have to keep saying that all the time, humanize ourselves. So we decided to take it to the next level and maybe humanize the space, the place we come from. So we humanize the city and give her a voice.
And it's really cool because there's a first-person narrative that goes through it. And that first-person narrator is the city of Lid, who's a diva, as you describe her.
Lid is an ancient city. It's more than 5,000 years old. It used to be the first capital of Palestine. Even if when I ask Palestinians about this, when I tell them about Lid and I ask, did you guys know that Lid was the first capital of Palestine? They're shocked. They have no idea. So it has this glorious, you know, rich history. But everyone seems to have forgotten about it. So when we personified Lid, when we started thinking about Lid as a character, we thought, okay, maybe
she's like a lounge singer that's seen better days and is now just draped over the piano in some dusty bar.
So let's take a look at another clip. This is of Issa Fanous, who is a resident of Lid. And let's take a look at what he has to say about what he witnessed and experienced as a young boy in Lid.
I don't know. This is me here. This is Samir al-Aboudi. He was with me. When the Israeli army took us to Damash Mosque to remove the dead bodies, the decomposed bodies smelled really bad. Dreadful. A week or two after the massacre, they took us in the Israeli army vehicles. Me, Samir Aboudi, Rashid Fanous, Khalil Abu Judub. No, Khalil al-Bele, Tulid. We weren't captives, we were children. Like me, maybe a little older. I was probably the youngest. They took us there, dropped us off. Take out the bodies. Pulling. The bodies were falling apart, rotted. The smell was horrendous. We'd take the bodies out and Israeli soldiers would burn them. At the end of the day, they would drive us back home. They took us 2 days in a row.
So what was that like talking to people about this experience? for both of you?
That specific Nakba survivor, Isa Fanous, who unfortunately passed away before we could finish the film. But fortunately, we had captured this account. When we started filming him, we did not know that he was going to tell us that. We were researching the story of the city, and obviously I'm from there, so I knew him. But I didn't know these specific details, and no one actually did. I knew that he was 12 years old. When we started the interview, all of a sudden he says this. And even his son was sitting in the next room, and he was shocked. He did not know that. It was like Isa was clearly traumatized. And so we had to be very sensitive with him. It was for me as a Palestinian, this came as a shock, but also not. Because, I mean, you hear these stories from the elders. It shows the importance of capturing these accounts and documenting them for the ages.
Yeah, because, you know, as you see at the end of our film, two of the people, the Nakba survivors that we filmed with have since passed away. And I think it's really, really important, all the people who are doing the work capturing the stories of Nakba survivors, because there isn't an archive of this history, and there really needs to be.
Also, Katie, I want to mention one more thing. I mean, we also documented people from the refugee camp. And these people are Lydians. I mean, they weren't alive in 1948. We filmed with the younger generation, the third generation of the Nakba survivors. And through their testimonies and accounts, you realize that when Palestinians talk about the occupation, they talk about the occupation of 1948. Now, when some liberals out there, and I'm including liberal Zionists, talk about the occupation, they talk about the occupation of 1967. To us, Palestinians, this was just the occupation 2.0. The original occupation, the mother of all sins, happened in 1948. And this is the root of all evil. If we want to truly understand the basis of the whole Israel-Palestine story, we need to go back to 1948 and understand it. And this is hopefully what our film provides, a little bit of background on the actual, you know, context of what's happening right now.
Rami, tell us about where you live and what your life is like as a Palestinian 48er and what that means.
So when we say 48er versus a 67er, 48er means a Palestinian from the land of 48, meaning the land that was occupied in 1948, meaning Israel, nowadays Israel. So I am a Palestinian citizen of Israel. I have Israeli ID. I pay taxes to the Israeli government, and I have an Israeli passport. There are about 2 million of us, and we are the Nakba survivors, the survivors. In 1948, more than 600 villages and towns were, you know,
decimated,
wiped out, and its population were expelled. But some remained. Some were able to survive in here. And we are the descendants of those who survived. So nowadays I live in Haifa, which is a city up north. It is a binational city, meaning it was a Palestinian city before 1948. It was occupied that year, and it became a city where you have an Israeli population and a Palestinian population living side by side. Not in coexistence. This was, it sounded like a little bit of kumbaya. It's not, there are a lot of tensions. As you can also see in the film, and lived as a city like Haifa. A while back, I just moved up north.
Some people will describe Israel as an apartheid state, and then other people will say, no, it's not, because they're Palestinians in the Knesset. What's your response to that?
I mean, it's the only democracy in the Milky Way galaxy, Israel. This is like, it has the most moral army in that galaxy. I mean, come on, seriously, that argument is... that argument is, to me, is unbearable. I mean, it's usually accompanied by, well, what do you want? You have 22 states. Just move away if you don't like it in here. Just like move to other places. I mean, just the sheer, like, you know, chutzpah of these arguments just tells you about the level of racism Israeli society can reach. So what if there's representation in the Israeli Knesset? Let's say the current members of the Knesset all decide to resign and say, we're not going to be members of the Israeli Knesset anymore. They're just going to bring new ones that will comply with whatever the Israeli mainstream wants. You know, so if we have representation, it's not necessary, because if we don't have them over there in the Knesset, then we have no one. Again, that doesn't mean they have any power that is of substance. I mean, I was in 2015, I was the spokesperson, a parliamentary consultant of Hanin Zoabi, a Palestinian member of the Knesset. And I left because I realized there was no, I didn't, other than writing press releases, I couldn't do shit. Like, I mean, I couldn't even pass a single bill. But however, being in that place provided us with some kind of access to media, access to international media. And, you know, Palestinians, they have daily lives. We're talking about a population of 2 million people. Someone does need to represent them at the end of the day. And we rather that these people will be, you know, with us, from us, as opposed to people that, you know, selected by the establishment, Arabs that are pet Arabs. And, you know, Katie, I was going to tell you one more thing. I was in San Diego about a week and a half ago. And over there in San Diego, there's a place called Balboa Park where they have houses of different countries. And there was the House of Palestine. And, you know, I think every country celebrates its day once or twice a year. I can't really remember. So there was the Day of Palestine. I think it was April 22nd or April 21st, something like that. So I was there and I went by the the House of Israel, and I saw like a poster with photos of Israeli Arabs. That's what they call us. Israelis, that's what they call us. We call ourselves Palestinians. Israeli Arabs. And they use them, like, you know, this woman, Lucy Hirsch, is a TV anchor. This person, Yusuf Haddad, is a Hasbara activist. And they use them as examples to show that Israel, supposedly, is not an apartheid state or is not a racist state, but a state that provides equal opportunities. Now, you come from the United States, and this country has a history of using people from, you know, people of color, people of, you know, who, as, you know, token individuals.
Like the people who voted against the ceasefire, for instance.
Exactly. You know, it's like token people. And this is, to me, this is just a joke. This is just a complete joke.
What kind of repression? I mean, I went to one of your screenings at DCTV where the film is playing for a couple more days. And before you go, of course, I want to hear, people want to know where they can watch the film. But you mentioned that the actress who did the voiceover of Lid had faced some problems. You said that you were afraid of saying certain things. You mentioned another musician, I believe, who lives in Israel, who's been in jail. Can you talk about the repression that is happening in Israel to Palestinians?
So regarding the actress in our film, she will talk. We rather that she speaks for herself when she decides to do so, just because she's based on legal counseling from her lawyers. She will do that when she's available. Her trial is still ongoing. After October 7th, there was an unprecedented level of repression that we haven't seen before, and was terrifying. It was completely terrifying. I, being a media public figure back home, I have received death threats in the past. I decided after October 7th not to post anything on my social media. I even decided not to leave my neighborhood. When I walked the dog, it was just around the block for the first few weeks. They arrested everyone on right and left. Obviously, the freedom to protest for free speech was taken away overnight from all Palestinian citizens of Israel. For example, there's a very famous Palestinian folk singer called Dalal Abu Amne, who I believe had an interview with the LA Times and the Washington Post, and I forgot where, but you can Google her. Her name is Dalal Abu Amne. On October 7th, she had an Instagram, I think, or a Facebook post. La ghalib illallah. There's no victor but God. Now, Dalal is a Muslim, and to Muslim people, saying no victor there's no victor but God. It's like saying, thank God. It's like something we say on a daily basis, a few times a day. My dad is, my dad prays, and he says that all the time. La hawla billah. They arrested her. They arrested her for that. And what happened afterwards? They started protesting outside her home every day. On every evening, they would come and protest outside her home. Her husband works in a hospital. They would go to a hospital where there are sick people there. Her husband is a physician, and they would protest outside. It was insane. They would target her children. The level of incitement, the level of persecution that we are facing after October 7th is unprecedented. Also, let me give you one more example. The Israeli chief of police, what did that guy, who's a public servant, what did that guy say after October 7th? If anyone wants to show solidarity or empathy with Gaza Strip, I will send them there myself. Meaning, this public servant who's in charge of law enforcement said, I am going to commit an illegal act that is undemocratic if you decide to show solidarity or empathy with your families and your friends and your people in Gaza. So this is what we have to go through as Palestinian citizens of Israel. And these are just like tiny examples. There's more. There's so much more. I did an interview with Al Jazeera that with a show called The Listening Post that was released on, I think they published it on December 16th. You can Google, you can YouTube it. It's available on YouTube. It was more than 2 months after the war had started. I didn't even share it on my social media. And, you know, fortunately, it's in English. Most Jewish supremacists who are super violent from back home do not understand English. So that went by, that went by somehow. But yeah, it is very, very, if you want to learn more about what it's like to be a Palestinian citizen of Israel, I suggest that people go and look it up as well.
And where can people see this film?
So the film has a few more days here. We're actually at the theater now at the DCTV Firehouse Cinema. It'll be screening through Thursday evening. And then it'll be playing at festivals in Houston and Chicago. We're going to be having a theatrical run with Lonely Theaters in LA and with the Hot Dog Cinema in Toronto. It's also international. It's in Nairobi right now. It's going to be in Australia, UAE. So if you go to the Lit in Exile website, it's Lit in Exile. You'll see all the screenings there. And you can also follow us on Instagram, Ramani Yunus and Sarah Friedland, or follow Lit in Exile on Instagram.
And any final words before you go to your screening?
We love you, Katie. Thank you for doing what you do. We need every American media person to tell the truth and to give voice to the people that don't have a voice at the moment. And to
stand up against our system and government, which you do so beautifully. Yeah. So thank you.
Well, one final question for me, actually. How are Palestinians in Israel viewing the protests that are happening here? I mean, not to suggest that it was a monolith, but yeah, as one.
Well, as a representative of all Palestinian people, no, Palestinians back home, this is the thing. I mean, Palestinians back home are watching and are in tears. I mean, we've never thought, I mean, I was on the phone with my mom the other week, a woman in her late 60s. She was almost in tears. She's usually very cynical. she told me that she never thought in her lifetime that she would get to see this happening in the United States. People are watching. People are inspired by these students and by what's happening in the United States. Keep going. Speaking up against what's happening in Gaza isn't about being pro-Palestinian. It's about being pro-humanity.
Well, thank you so much. And everyone should go see Lit. It's really great.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks. Okay, that was great. And we have more to go, but that was so good. And please do go see that movie. You'll really like it. It's really cool. There's really great animation. We didn't have enough time to get into all of it, but there's really cool animation and they really create like the world that they would like to see. So it's very moving. Let's see. We are going to bring in our next guest. So excited to have coming back to the show, the great activist and Code Pink co-founder, Medea Benjamin, the great journalist and activist and organizer, Bryce Green. And we are also very excited to have Aiden Hamis, who is making his debut. He is a sophomore at Indiana University and a lead organizer with Palestine Solidarity Committee at Indiana University Divestment Coalition. And he and Bryce were both arrested at the Gaza encampment. So welcome, Bryce, Medea, and Aiden. Hello.
How you doing?
How's it going?
Hello. Great to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining. So I wanted to talk to you all about the repression that we're seeing. Obviously, there's genocide in Gaza, and then there's repression here, there's protests here. And then I want to talk to you about the role of the media. But let's start off by taking a look at you, Medea. Recently, you just got arrested interrupting Lloyd Austin. So let's take a look at that clip. But before we do that, let's set up why you went there and where he was speaking.
Well, what was interesting, Katie, is that we didn't even know he was going to be speaking. I just happened to walk by the hearing. It wasn't announced. And usually they announce these hearings at least a couple of days in advance. And I opened the door to the armed services and realized that he was going to be speaking there and that there was a seat open. So I ran in and grabbed it. This was definitely not planned. So you could show it. But one thing I do want to say is that talking about media censorship, the camera was panned to to Secretary Austin. I was right behind him. And as soon as I got up to speak, they cut that and turned it around so you couldn't see me and you could only hear. So I think that was obviously intentionally done.
Wow. Interesting and not surprising. So let's take a look at this clip of Medea doing what she does best, which is getting arrested for speaking truth to power.
Grateful for our partners in Congress who help.
How can you talk about U.S. leadership when we're supporting genocide in Gaza?
Committee will come to order.
It is illegal. It is immoral. It is disgusting. The whole world is watching what we are doing in Gaza right now. Secretary General, you are supporting a genocide. Stop supporting genocide. Free Palestine. Yeah. So I spoke out at the hearing where General Austin was talking about U.S. leadership. And I said, how can you talk about U.S. leadership when the U.S. is supporting genocide and the whole world is watching as the U.S. is sending weapons that violate U.S. laws, violate international laws, violate world opinion, violate basic decency and morality. We have to speak out. And I'm wearing a T-shirt that says, another Jew that speaks out against genocide.
Well, please stay back and not interfere.
She will be searched again before she gets in the way.
What is in there? What is a harm to everyone are all these Congress people who just voted for $70 billion more for going to Israel. Every one of them had blood on their hands. Those are the ones that should be arrested. I am proud to have stood up. We are all doing what we can. We must stop our government, even if it means going to jail for justice.
You're arresting the wrong person.
Wow. So I'm surprised they let you in there after all these times.
Well, I just walked in really quickly. Usually they don't even let us into that Armed Services Committee, even though it's a public hearing. And then I was able to come back after I got let out. And we confronted General Austin in the halls as he was leaving as well. So, you know, I feel that every opportunity we have to grab it. And not only confront people like the generals who come in to testify, but confront all of these members of Congress, the vast majority of whom just voted for another $17 billion to go to Israel just last week.
Disgusting. And you also, Medea, were involved in the flotilla. Can you give us an update on that?
The flotilla is a magnificent project that has antecedents that go way back into the 2004, I think, was the first one. And the first ones actually made it through to Gaza, but then Israel started stopping those ships on the high seas in international waters in 2010, boarded the Turkish vessel called Mavi Marmara and killed 10 people aboard. This time, there were thousands of people who wanted to go on this ship and hundreds of us who are coming from other countries, and we amassed in Istanbul And we got a very big ship this time that could hold about 1,000 people, as well as a cargo ship that was huge and is supplied with over 5,000 tons of desperately needed humanitarian aid. But there has been so much pressure from Israel and the United States and Germany on the Turkish government that they delayed in getting us, giving us the permission to leave. And then the country whose flag we were flying under, you know, each big ship has to have a country's flag. And it was Guinea-Bissau. They at the last minute pulled their flag under pressure from Israel and the United States. So we still hope to go. It looks like there are other countries who are willing to provide that flag. And we have to see if Turkey is indeed going to allow us to go. It will probably take a few more weeks, but we hope the flotilla will set sail.
So, Medea, you've been organizing, protesting, supporting Gaza through the flotilla. And we have two other guests here, Aiden and Bryce, who have been doing the work by protesting and organizing at a student encampment. Tell us about your experiences, Aiden and Bryce.
Aiden, you want to start or I can?
I think the fact that I'm in a room that I can't be quiet is emblematic of that, because I've been banned from campus for a year, along with Bryce, who's actually been banned for 5 years. But I guess what we've been seeing is, military level repression, especially on our campus after engaging in our encampment, you know, armed to the brim, Bearcat, tear gas grenades, assault rifles, pepper bullets, and so on and so forth. And so it's really indicative of these universities are far more willing to brutalize their students than divest from genocide.
We launched this encampment in solidarity with what we were seeing in Columbia, Harvard, Austin, and all these other schools doing an occupation in support of Gaza. And we thought, well, it's time to act on our university. But we all understand that the only reason that this war continues, that this occupation continues over all these decades, is because America, Americans, and American institutions support Israel unconditionally, and any person of conscience needs to stand up and fight back against that sort of thing. And like Aiden said, we were met with military levels of repression. They busted out riot shields, heavy armor, military vehicles. There was a drone circling overhead, a helicopter flying around. And they even put a sniper on the roof and aimed directly at student protesters. Not only did they do this and arrest, dozens of people, but they did it twice. And so the ostensible reason for the state troopers' repression against us, and I want to point out that this wasn't local Indiana University Police Department. This wasn't even Bloomington Police Department. This went to the state. This went to the governor's office. So they sent the governor's office into a small town, a small college town, with military levels of force to remove a tent. That was the reason that they gave for justifying their force, that there was a tent in a park. And of course, we all know that that isn't the actual reason. We know that the real reason that they repress us is because we're supporting a movement that is against genocide. We are challenging these structures of power that support the state of Israel and support the occupation and support all the death, murder, and destruction that's caused by it. If we were protesting with a tent for something like, I don't know, better lunches in the cafeterias, do you think that they would have called in state troopers and, you know, military level vehicles and aiming at kids with a sniper on the roof? No, they did this because we're fighting power. They did this because we are challenging the status quo. And we have to if we are able to maintain our humanity in this genocide.
And I just want to add off Bryce's point. I think it's so emblematic of the level of force they're willing to use. I mean, like I said, I always tell people, you know, in my circles that I don't think, it's not about thinking that it, the reality is that Western academia is not failing us in this sense. It's built to do this. It's built to support genocide through, you know, hundreds of years of colonialism. But what scares these individuals who uphold the status quo primarily is that these students, us and so on and so forth, and across the country are not fearful, because regardless of the military repression that we're facing, it is so minuscule compared to the violence that is being unleashed in Gaza right now, incomparable to the past 75 years of occupation, of genocide, and so on and so forth. And that's where they see, that's what they know, that you know, these students are essentially creating their own university, their own new world.
And Aiden, you're a Palestinian, right?
Yeah, correct.
Can you tell us about your family's story?
So my family's story, I'm from, my family is from northern occupied Palestine, as Rami said, 48er land, from Safad. Most of my family is now in refugee camps in Lebanon, but I did spend some time in Ramallah, and I have a lot of very close friends there. And you know, just hearing from them too about the student movement, that the student intifada is what they're referring to it. You know, and to know that we are doing this for them and for Gaza, for all those in Gaza. You know, I think, like Rami said, like it's empowering on another. It's empowering to really firmly stand in humanity in that aspect.
And we actually have a photo of you, Bryce, getting arrested.
All right, let's see it.
Okay, here it is. There's you getting arrested. We also have a photo of a sniper on the roof, which is unbelievable that they have snipers there. We have a photo of, I believe, the police from behind. There they are. Is that them with their sniper, with their guns?
Yes. I think this is on day 3 of the encampment.
The snipers were there those first 3 days, and the school and the town were trying to say they're not snipers. And then they were being escorted by administration. Right.
And then we have some footage of some arrests happening at Dunn, arrest in Dunn Meadow.
The people united will never be defeated.
Now, remember, this is because of a tent. Look at the level of force. Look at the weapons that they're using.
This is so crazy. And this is actually a fairly tame police response. I mean, we've seen some people being thrown in much more brutal ways. Not that this is okay, but this really pales in comparison to, I mean, that's awful. But we've seen even worse at other universities.
This is true. And of course, like Aiden said, the reason that these students are so passionate is because this is nothing compared to what's going on in Gaza. You know, we say that we're protesting against our university and we want our university to divest from this genocidal enterprise and all of these genocidal enterprises. And, you know, we criticize our president. We're calling on them to resign, all these administrators. But at least we have a university. You know, all the universities in Gaza have been targeted and destroyed with deliberate precision, because Israel wants to destroy the entire culture of Palestine, and American institutions enable it. And, you know, we've seen a lot of support from faculty members and, you know, staff who are outraged at this level of military force, but they don't necessarily have a critique of what's going on in Palestine. And so, you know, you got to ask them, well, if you're this horrified at seeing riot cops beat up your students, why aren't you this horrified at watching the America give bombs to Israel to blow up entire universities, could blow them up with controlled demolition, to, you know, murder people, stick them in mass graves? I mean, we've all seen the images. We've all read the reports. But the fact that people are concerned about, you know, this violence when it comes home, I think is emblematic of the way that American psychology has been cultivated to allow for this genocide.
Now, I want to ask Bryce and Aiden what your asks are to the university. And then, Medea, I want to ask you what your asks are to the government.
So I think for us, our three firm acts, and, you know, some are a little more firm than others, are the end of the Korean partnership on this campus. And that's a $110 million investment in Crane Naval Base in Indiana, and developing, you know, AI and so intelligences or so on and so forth. But Crane does, it's partnered with Israeli defense companies in in developing weaponry that is being used in Gaza right now, AI optic sight that is supposedly makes a rifle much more accurate and so on and so forth. And we know determinately that that is going to murdering Palestinians en masse, executing. And again, that Ukraine is responsible for distributing 2,000-pound bombs. Our second demand is financial transparency and full divestment. I mean, these two material demands are our most firm ones. You know, that IU make a financial portfolio of its connection to Israel, and that it divest its funding in its entirety. And then our third is, you know, the complete resignation of the big three on our administration, because we know structurally that this institution, you know, is made to be complicit in genocide. But these admin have gone above and beyond to serve these crimes against humanity. They have gone above and beyond to double down, and they're not, I would rather use partnership instead of just complicity, full-blown partnership in genocide. And, you know, those are, that's what we hold to.
Yeah, well, couldn't have said it better myself. These are demands, and we hope to keep this encampment until these demands are met.
How is this university and other American universities, and then I'll turn to you, Medea, to ask you about your demands, but how is Indiana University and how are other universities complicit and partners in this genocide?
The partnership with Crane that Aiden mentioned is one of the big ones. You know, if they're recruiting out of this university, if they're allowing for research partnerships, if they're, you know, basically running press releases for Crane whenever they do something cool and say that, look at this partnership, look what it produced. And it's, you know, death and destruction. That's a direct way in which these universities are complicit in the genocide. But in another important way, they condition the general public in America to be accepting of genocide, to at least be able to justify it in their brains by perpetuating the ideological climate that makes Israel acceptable, that makes Palestine stigmatized, and that smears criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic. The university culture has been doing that for quite some time. In fact, Indiana University signed a partnership agreement with the Israel on Campus Coalition, which is one of the major college-level Israel lobbying groups aimed at, again, maintaining the status quo, ensuring that students have a favorable view of Israel, a negative view of Palestine, or maybe no view of Palestine at all. It's one of these ways that the culture is shifted in order to serve Israel and its genocidal intent and empire writ large. And of course, Indiana University as an R1 institution has a lot of these partnerships, and disclosing them and divesting from them is the first step in, you know, in ending this partnership in genocide. And that's the same for a lot of different universities around the world, especially the larger research-oriented ones.
Thank you. That was really helpful. Medea, what are your demands? What are your asks?
Well, for many months, we have been in the halls of Congress every day trying to get them to stop sending more weapons to Israel. And unfortunately, that vote happened last week in which both the House and the Senate agreed to send $17 billion more in weapons to Israel. So now we're looking for how can we call on members of Congress to halt the transfer of weapons because Israel is violating U.S. laws and international laws. And there's a couple of hooks that we are trying to hold on to coming up. One is May 8th, when the State Department is supposed to turn in a report to Congress on the use of those weapons. And we already know from a leaked document through Reuters that there are branches of the State Department that are saying that Israel is indeed violating U.S. law. Now, will those be silenced and will it just be a whitewashed report that is given to Congress? We don't know, probably. In any case, we're waiting for that. But in the meantime, there was another leak from Politico yesterday that a letter is being drafted to the Justice Department, to Merrick Garland, by lawyers, including lawyers within the Biden administration, saying that the weapons that the U.S. gives to Israel is being used to violate U.S. and international law. Now, for the others of us, you know, on this show and people listening, they probably say, duh. But this is important in that it's coming from lawyers in and outside the administration and will give us another hook to use. And so we are going to members of Congress to say to them, you must halt the transfer of weapons to Israel. And that is our ask right now.
We're going to be talking more about the way the media is participating in this genocidal onslaught on Gaza. And a perfect segue, I think, from talking about protests to talking about the media is to show what happened to you, Medea, when you were protesting at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So let's take a look at the protest, and then let's take a look at what happened to you, and then we'll talk about it. Okay, so that's the protest in front of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Tell us what you were trying to do, Medea, when you were there.
Well, we got a room inside the hotel, and we unfurled a huge 40-foot banner, a Palestinian flag, but they didn't even know who it was who did it because we got out of the room quick enough. And then we were downstairs with a very tiny sign that said 100 members of the press killed in Gaza, and just holding up that sign, two of us, we got attacked, really brutally assaulted, thrown down the stairs, held on the ground, and then not only kicked out of the hotel, but signed something saying we were banned for 5 years to come back into that hotel. And this is all at a celebration of free speech, of journalism. And I also want to say that at the same time that we were there with that tiny little sign, there was a group of people with Stand With Ukraine signs and Ukraine flags that were right next to us. And of course, nothing happened to them.
And let's take a look at the footage of them roughing you up.
White
House Correspondents' Dinner in the Hilton Hotel, and actually had a room here. And I was standing here quietly with this sign and got so roughed up by the security and thrown out of the hotel.
You journalists, come over here. Hello, journalists, come here. We're being assaulted for First Amendment right of free speech.
Help!
Help us, please.
Help!
Help!
Help us!
You better not be putting your hands on us. You better not be putting
It's quite ironic because tonight was all about press freedom, and it seems like standing here with the sign is something that's a lot worse than 100 journalists in Gaza being killed.
And let's take a look at the injury that you posted. So what is that from?
That's from getting thrown down the stairs and grabbed on my leg as they picked me up.
Wow.
And I just do want to reiterate with what Bryce and Aiden have been saying, though, how minor this is compared to what happens to people in Gaza. And we don't want to make it about us. We want to make it about what is it that we're trying to bring up. And that is the 100 members of the press who've been murdered by the Israelis. And the fact that they could go in with their gowns, disregard the call by the journalists in Gaza to boycott that, to go in and have a wonderful meal while people are starving, and to laugh. It's all about laughing and making jokes about politics is so disgusting. And, you know, that's a little bit of what we were trying to bring out. And the protests outside were really wonderful. People made the vests that say press and the names of the dead journalists and put them on the ground. And these people had to step over the vests as they were trying, as they were going into this fancy dinner. So I think it is a time to say that journalism, mainstream journalism, not journalism like you, Katie, is just, Aidan, what did you say? It's not only complicit, it's, what did you call it?
Full-blown partnership.
A partnership. Absolutely. I'm going to start using that from now on, not talk about complicity. You're right. It's a total partnership, and it is so sickening. And that evening to watch them having a good time together and laughing about what's happening both domestically and internationally was really quite disgusting.
Do you know if there were any jokes in the correspondents' dinner about the Gaza coverage?
No, there weren't jokes about it, but it was mentioned so briefly in passing by the head of the Correspondents' Association. But in contrast, when they mentioned Evan, what's his name, Katie Gosevich,
from who's in Russia,
the Wall Street Journal journalist who's being held in Russia, they all got up to applaud his family who was there, recognize them. And of course, not a word about someone like Shireen Abu Akleh or a mention of the names of any of the journalists who have been killed in Gaza.
Or Julian Assange, of course.
Or Julian Assange.
In fact, we have that clip. Can we play that clip of the statement about the journalists who risk their lives or are in jail because of journalism?
Wall Street Journal, they are counting. For Moscow correspondent Evan Griskovich, 396 days. Since he was jailed in Russia, the U.S. government has designated Evan as wrongfully detained. And Evan's parents and his family are with us tonight.
Oh, not the stand-up. Oh, no.
With you, always.
Yep.
We remember Austin Tice.
I wonder if Annette Schwartz got invited.
Days, nearly 12 years since he was kidnapped in Syria. His mother, Deborah, is with us. And Mrs. Tice, we are with you. And Mr. President, again, we humbly ask that you do everything you can to bring them home.
And then she says something right there. She does mention the journalists in Gaza who have been killed, but she certainly doesn't mention who killed them.
So it's a standing ovation listing all these journalists saying, thank you, President Biden. Please bring them home. And also there are journalists in Gaza dying. So, well, now let's move on.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. And not only also are there journalists dying in Gaza, but also there's a journalist who you could free with the snap of your fingers with one phone call named Julian Assange. But yes, it's not. There's no connection between the United States government funding genocide and the death of journalists in Gaza. They make it seem like it's almost as kind of natural as they make hunger sound as opposed to an inflicted famine. You know, they talk about starvation in Gaza to make it seem like it's a natural disaster. They do the same thing with the journalism.
And never a mention, no. Katie, of the word Israel throughout the whole evening.
No.
It really highlights just how disgusting the national media is on this issue and how they are able to manipulate and manufacture the images in order to make themselves seem like, you know, defenders of freedom, bringers of truth, and, you know, real principled people. Whereas in reality, those principles are out the door. I remember the CNN reporter who said that the Palestinians were going to employ something called the victim doctrine, which is to make themselves appear like victims to gain sympathy from the world. That's Joseph Goebbels would be proud of that. He'd be impressed. Like that, it's truly evil, and everyone in that room supports a system that works like that.
Also, we have another clip because Bryce. I don't know. I'm not sure if I agree with you. There's something I think you're not giving Joe Biden and this country credit for, and that is something called decency. Let's take a look at what Colin Jost, the host, MC of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, had to say about his dear grandfather and who he voted for and why.
Grandfather, a Staten Island firefighter, voted for you, Mr. President. He voted for you in the last election that he ever
voted. Does he even know what state he's in?
I mean, I'm sure someone else will vote twice in this election using his name, but that's just how the Democratic machine works. He voted for you, and the reason that he voted for you is because you're a decent man.
This is the most insufferable thing I've ever seen.
Disgusting.
My grandpa voted for decency, and decency is why we're all here tonight. Decency is how we're able to be here tonight.
You know, a lot of people don't know the lesson of, you know, the media is manipulated.
Decency is how we're able to make jokes about each other and one of us doesn't go to prison after.
Let's hope Biden goes to prison.
We go to the Newsmax after party.
Bryce, you should say how you got 5-year ban.
And when you look at the levels of freedom throughout history and even around the world today, this is the exception. This freedom is incredibly rare.
I couldn't help but notice, by the way, when he says you can make a joke and not get into trouble, I couldn't help but think of Rafat Alarir, the Palestinian poet, professor, mentor, who was killed by Israel, who just lost, by the way, his daughter, son-in-law, and grandchild. But he was killed by Israel in December. He was targeted. He was killed in his sister's apartment building. It wasn't just the building. It was actually just that apartment. And a large reason that people were so upset at him, besides being an outspoken defender of Palestinian rights and critic of Israel and the United States, is because he made a joke that was making fun of Zionist hysteria and lying. I'm sure Colin Jost doesn't know about that, though.
Well, didn't he say he blamed Barry Weiss? Wasn't it Barry Weiss like called him out?
Yeah, he said he blamed, yeah, because Barry Weiss tweeted about this joke he made, where he was making fun of this lie. I mean, it wasn't offensive because he wasn't making fun of a baby being dead. He was making fun of the claims about a baby being baked in an oven, which wasn't true. So the punchline of that joke was like Zionist hysteria who had lied about this.
All right. What did he say? He was like, yeah, did they use baking soda?
Soda or something, yeah.
And then his DMs were filled with such obscenities before he was killed.
Yeah.
It was one of the most beyond shameful things.
We actually found that Rafiat had commented on one of the Twitter accounts of a Zionist organizer on our campus, you know, just calling him out for his nonsense. But, you know, a lot of people here in the encampment, you know, they don't necessarily, they didn't grow up reading and watching, you know, Chomsky and Manufacturing Consent, and they don't know that the media does just straight up lie and invent things and manipulate and distort. But a lot of people in this encampment are learning this right now. In fact, there was a piece yesterday from our local Fox affiliate. You know, they sent a guy down and, you know, we interviewed with him, we talked with him. He was a perfectly normal, affable guy. And then we look at this segment, you know, 1 minute and 30 seconds. And in it, there's a little point where he said he interviews like a Zionist rabbi on campus who hates us and has been, you know, verbally abusing us for quite some time. And he says that, oh, you know, the rabbi is concerned that chants of intifada, which translate to death to Jews. Like he just said that it's an obvious lie. Either he's quoting the rabbi and he didn't bother checking it, or he is he thinks that intifada means death to Jews. In any case, that's just journalistic malpractice. Some people saw this and were, you know, shocked. It was like, oh, how could the media say something like that? It's obviously not true. I even called the station just to correct them, but I don't think it'll have an effect because, you know, they're not there to be fact-checking and to speak truth to power or to, you know, cover the social movements of our time. They're there because you know, they want to make content, and they want to make content in a way that doesn't get them fired. And the best way to do that is to appeal to the dominant ideologies. And those dominant ideologies are, of course, uncritical, unconditional, unlimited support for Israel. And any criticism of Israel will be met with punishment, and it's anti-Semitic. That's the line that a lot of these media organizations watch. But to watch them lie like that, he even cited a state trooper who said that the reason for the violence that they used on the protesters was because they were worried that hate speech, quote unquote, hate speech, might turn into violence. If anyone who was on the ground that day knows that not a word of that was said by the state troopers, and, you know, we have, it's all recorded, it's all there, it's all easy to figure out. The reason that they went into the camp was because there was a tent up, and that is against the policies that they were told to enforce. So they made up this pretext after the fact, you know, the hate speech or violence after the fact. And of course, you have the state police trooper head cop.
I like pig, so try not to call them that.
Yeah. But whatever, he just made up this story. It was like, oh, yes, you know, we saw all these hate speech and we were just worried about the safety of the nonsense. But it was reported uncritically by the media, you know, and of course, that affects public opinion and how people view these protests. And of course, while they were saying that we're anti-Semitic, they put my face up there, had a, it is me chanting. That's how they manipulate, and that's how they maintain this support for genocide.
Right. Well, I know Medea has to go, but I'd love to keep talking with you, Bryce and Aiden, if you have a couple more minutes about media bias.
Yeah, we got a little bit.
Okay, great. Medea, thank you for joining.
Thank you so much for having me on, and with two fantastic guests that I really admire, and power to the students.
We love you, Medea.
Thanks, Medea.
Bye-bye.
Well, we may have, I'm definitely going to start, keep talking with you guys, but we may have a special third guest coming in.
This is exciting. I'm going to get a drum roll.
It's someone who can't usually join because she's not based in the States. It is Rama Zain, the great Egyptian journalist who yelled at Clarissa Ward once and told her how, you know, how they weren't doing their jobs. And she's been on Piers Morgan and she's destroyed Piers Morgan. So we're going to have her on soon. So that's exciting.
I'll at least stay on long enough to say hi and, you know, express how much we both hate Clarissa Ward.
Yeah, it's going to be a short, it'll be a very short segment. I just want to bring her on because she wants to come on now that we can do it because she's based in Egypt usually. So Bryce, tell us about some of the worst media malpractice we've been seeing around this genocidal war. And Aiden, of course, your opinion also.
Well, you know, an interesting thing that happened was a New York Times reporter showed up to the encampment at Indiana University. And, you know, the New York Times is god-awful on this issue and has put out many pieces of misinformation designed to justify the genocide. And so, you know, the New York Times reporter shows up. Again, another normal, nice, affable guy. He's not at the international desk. He's more of a Midwestern beat guy. But I think the story has come out by now, so we'll see. But I haven't read it yet. But he was reporting on these encampments, you know, talking about Palestine, talking about Gaza. And I asked him, I was like, well, you work for the New York Times. How do you view your paper's coverage of this issue? And he leans back. He goes, well, you know, I think they've been pretty fair. And I said, well, I mean, you heard about the scandal with that story, with the Screams Without Words. And he said, oh, no, I don't know that story. I don't know the one. He had never heard of it. I was like, it was pretty big. The New York Times conducted an investigation into its own staff based on the leaks that were going to the media about the production of this story. And he's like, oh, well, you know, send it to me. I'll check it out. So I sent it over to him, and he was around today, and he still hasn't read it. But it's astounding to me that this guy thought so highly of his paper that he worked for without even understanding the main criticisms of it, understanding what people were saying about it, understanding how they completely fabricated material. I mean, it's like a journalist covering Iraq war protests and saying that, oh, well, you know, I think the New York Times coverage of the Iraq war has been, you know, pretty fair and balanced, maybe a little rah-rah America, but, you know, overall fair. Meanwhile, you know, Judy Miller is publishing the most insane shit you've ever seen in your life. And but again, it's another lesson. The way the media functions is not necessarily through a bunch of malicious individuals. It's through systems and structures, willful ignorance and useful idiots. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that this guy's malicious or even an idiot, but he certainly was ignorant about his paper's role in perpetuating the genocide. And hopefully he gives that piece a read and rethinks his position. But I don't know, Aiden, what have you been seeing?
Well, yeah, I mean, the reality is that, you know, this Western journalism is just being, it's a mouthpiece for empire. You know what I mean? Like to what you said, Bryce, the whole process of manufacturing consent. And I think it plays into the role of like university institutions too, like this intellectual obfuscation, like Palestinians somehow found somewhere, we don't know, you know, passed away without referring to, you know, the explicit execution of children by the Israeli occupation forces, the explicit targeting, explicit, you know, bombings and so on and so forth in every aspect. And I just think about it too, and in the way students act on campus, and I have to believe a lot of the way they act is media. Some are obviously, you know, especially from the Zionist camp, pro-genocide, but, you know, there's these students who just go about their lives like nothing is going on. You know what I mean? Nothing. And that's in part because of the intensive, you know, psychological, weaponry almost that Western journalism has set on, you know, that people who are not necessarily engaged in and sort of like critical analyses or so on and so forth, you and not put in a position where they need to will, you know, they're one, plenty of them will not care because they're depraved, morally depraved and racist and Zionist. But, you know, there's those who are just so, everything becomes so obfuscated, you know, it just pacifies the masses.
Well, I have an example that just happened, if you want to see some New York Times bias. So here is something that was edited. They edited an abstract. So in an article says, universities face an urgent question, what makes a protest anti-Semitic? And the abstract originally said, pro-Palestine student activists, many of whom are Jewish, say their movement is anti-Zionist, but not anti-Semitic. It is not a distinction that everyone buys. All right. But now they changed it to pro-Palestinian student activists say their movement is anti-Zionist, but not anti-Semitic. It's not a distinction everyone buys. So they have to erase something saying that many of the pro-Palestine protesters are Jewish, because that undermines the narrative that the pro-Palestine protesters are anti-Semitic. So they have to remove that.
Yeah, that account, editing the gray lady, is excellent. It is excellent for catching up stuff like this, because, you know, it happens more than you'd think. And I think most people in journalism school are taught that if you make a change to your article that affects the content, then you should probably tell your readers. You should probably put an editor's note that says, you know, this change was made for this reason, at this time, at this date, and we're sorry, we want to do better. They don't do that.
Yeah, it's called a stealth edit.
Stealth edit. And, you know, it happened in Gaza. It happened during, especially during the Ukraine war, when there would be some embarrassing piece of information that would paint Ukraine in a negative light. It would be, you know, there would be a headline that says, like, you know, Ukraine screws up bad. And then they would change it to Ukraine makes minor setback, or, you know, obviously, throwaway example, but that was the nature of the coverage. And that is the nature of how these media institutions work to engineer and maintain consent for their empire. And it's not, again, it's not the journalists themselves who are doing this. The journalist, the editor, you know, they might write a perfectly good, reasonable, balanced piece. But then once it gets to the higher ups, they might say, taking out that, changing the title, changing the abstract. Okay. And then by the time it gets published in the paper, the original journalist might not even recognize their work. But that's the media system we live in. It's a propaganda system. And everyone needs to learn some intellectual self-defense if they want to make sense of the world. And this Gaza issue is one of the, you know, the more blatant examples of how this system works.
Yeah. And how about the story about someone at a protest said death to JEWS, and because of that, the protest was shut down and the protesters were arrested. This was at Northeastern in Boston. And the person who said it was a pro-Israel protester.
Yeah. You ever wonder why the Zionists on campus do so many false flags against themselves?
I was going to say it's emblematic because when the Zionists were lining up cheering as the military police was unleashed, many of them performed, you know, the Nazi salute, you know, as a associating Palestinians with Nazis. And also, we had seen and heard from our other organizers that, you know, the Proud Boys were also standing with them. So I think that's all you really need to know.
And you were you were banned for a year, Aiden, and you were banned for 5 years, Bryce? Under why?
I was banned for a year. That's why I referred earlier, talking about, well, you know, in Russia, you can't make a joke. Well, Bryce made a joke and got 5 year ban.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What happened was, you know, they took us to processing and they gave us the ban from campus, IUPD did. And then mine had, 4/27/24 to 4/28/25. Now, the previous round of arrest, they messed up someone's ban and ended up banning them for only one day on accident. You know, they put the same year. So, you know, I, being a smartass, I asked them, I was like, well, hey, can you guys change mine to 25 to a 24? And they said, no. And then when I got the sheet back, when I was released, they had crossed out the 24 and it read 2029.
What?
So I'm banned for 5 years. I'm not certain about the causality, but I mean, the sequence of events speaks for itself, I think.
Wow. That is really disturbing.
But, you know, we're appealing the bans and we're trying to get things, pull it together so we can. I don't want to be banned from the university. There's work to do. This university still, invests in genocide, and it's easier to fight that if I can be there.
We keep talking about how much we want to focus on what's happening in Palestine, and of course we do. But I also think it's worth showing how the lengths to which the media goes to delegitimize these protests, because it's the same narrative that they're using against all Palestine supporters, which is that people support Palestine because they're hateful or anti-Semitic, or even now there's someone saying it's because it's popular, that's a cool thing to do, or because they don't have enough sex. I don't know if you saw that, but someone said that. I think it was Scott Galloway.
I saw that.
But here's Biden's comment on the protests. Statement from Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates on behalf of Biden, obviously. President Biden has stood against repugnant anti-Semitic smears and violent rhetoric his entire life. He condemns the use of the term intifada, as he has the other tragic and dangerous hate speech displayed in recent days. President Biden respects the right to free expression, but protests must be peaceful and lawful. Forcibly taking over buildings is not peaceful. It is wrong. And hate speech and hate symbols have no place in America.
Well, thank you, Joe Biden, for that crock of shit. You know, it's again, like I said, in that piece that the Fox affiliate ran yesterday, they simply said that intifada translates to death to Jews.
And it's really uprising or shaking off.
Yeah. I mean, it's the easiest thing in the world to Google. And if you've looked at Palestine for more than a day or two, you've heard the term and seen the term intifada. And you know that it doesn't mean what he said it means, but they printed it anyway and they just moved right on. That is how these protests are delegitimized.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the intifada part, the first part example of how to morally judge the word is the fact that the Warsaw Ghetto uprising is referred to as intifada in Arabic. You know, that's one of the clearest things you need to know.
Very important point. Well, we, as promised, are going to be joined by Rema Zain, who is joining from her car, I think. So this is going to be a little shaky, but she really wanted to join and make some comments and talk to us because she's usually in Egypt, but she's stateside now. So here we are. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Katie. Yes, I'm sorry. It is quite impromptu, but I'm glad to join in, even in a car, on a plane, whichever.
You were recently on Piers Morgan, and I believe you wanted to talk about that exchange that you had with him and also the son of one of the heads of Hamas. Is that how he's introduced?
Yes, that is how he's introduced. So what I was going to say was, it was very interesting that the show had been calling me to go on for a long time, a lot of times. And I'd always say no, because I thought, you know, there's absolutely no point to it. And I did agree to go on the show. And I was quite surprised that 6 months later, we are having the same questions being addressed to us, and we're having to repeat ourselves. And I think it dawned on me then and there, and how scary it was, that it wasn't that you're debating, it wasn't that you're giving facts of the matter as to what's happening, is that you are convincing the other party that Arab life is as worthy. And that is the scariest thing. When it dawns on you that these conversations are not debates where you're bringing in facts or you're discussing the fact of the matter or the continued onslaught, the fact that 5 or 6 months later, I am being asked the same questions and the 40,000 Palestinians killed is being ignored is extremely scary, because you realize that you're not dealing with people who don't know what's happening. You're dealing people that know exactly what's happening, but simply think that you are lesser than. So how can I start this conversation if you are looking at me and think that my life is worth less than a person of the West? And that is what is scary. And this is why these student movements are extremely important now. They're extremely important. And though they're trying to discredit them, it's not working. Because there's only so much you can do to hide the sun. And it just, it was really hurtful for me, because at one point, even during the interview, I froze. Because the realization that you are looking and talking to someone who is thinking that your life is not worth it, there's no point then. How do you move on from there? How do you solve anything from there? How do you have a constructive conversation from there? If the person is looking at you straight in the face, asking you the same questions, despite 40,000 Palestinian deaths later.
Yeah, he wrote a piece, Pierce Morgan, for the New York Post, about how our parents letting their kids be hateful and say anti-Jewish things. That's his line. His lane is that, and he loves asking people to condemn Hamas. That's one of his favorites.
Exactly. And then there was another point when discussing the students that are there. First of all, this is important to note, Katie. If you look at everyone who's gone on the show that is speaking for Palestine, you're going to notice that there are people from all walks of life saying different things, but going to the same goal of freedom. When you look at the people who are speaking up for Zionism and speaking against these students, they regurgitate almost a press release type of messaging. They keep reiterating the same thing. Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. They keep repeating the Hamas. They keep reiterating the same things about Hamas, trying to discredit the students, talking about infiltration from Islamists. It's absolutely ridiculous.
And you've been to protests, right?
I've been to these protests. You have people from all walks of life. It was very bizarre for them to tell me how do the Jewish students feel when right next to me were Jewish students. And they're one of the most vocal about what's going on. You have Muslim students, you have Christian students. It's not about the religion, and absolutely ridiculous for them to try and sway the narrative towards that. Think about it. Guys, I'm shocked. Think about it. At the end of the day, how are you defending people stuck under rubble, being killed by thousands? How are you defending children being abducted from their homes? Every day is a new atrocity. Every day is a war crime. It's insane. There's no point in debating anymore. And this is why this student movement is imperative. Everybody speaking up is imperative, because it dawns on you that you're not trying to debate the other person. You're trying to convince them that my life is worth it, that you shouldn't rob me, that you shouldn't murder me. Do you have a discussion after that if the infrastructure of it is racist, if the infrastructure of it is supremacist, if the infrastructure of it is that you are thinking that I am lesser than? And it's true. And this is why we see these token colored politicians, whether Arab or African American, they're the scariest. And the only reason they're allowed on the table is because they're on script. But notice when they go off script, they're no longer invited. They're no longer the decision makers. You are allowed in as a colored person as long as you speak like us. That is it. Otherwise, you are shunned, you are discredited, you are called barbaric, you are made to seem a terrorist. You've had all kinds of names being thrown at these protesters. Protesters who are saying genocide is wrong. Can you fathom that? When you actually think about it, you realize how farcical it all is. How dare you? At one point, you realize that these students are not scared of being suspended, of being expelled. They are more scared to live in a world that is okay with a televised genocide. I am more scared to live in a world where war criminals are recording videos of them toying with Palestinian women's lingerie, of dead and displaced women's lingerie, than live in a world where I'm going to get expelled, where I'm going to be kicked out of the system. What kind of world is it? So if anything, these students are the smartest ones on there because there's this void of leadership and they've realized that they need to step in. They've been waiting for the adult in the room and no one showed up. So they're the ones that are showing up. They keep waiting for someone to speak up and it's not happening. So of course they're going to fill in that void. Of course they're going to speak up because there's only so much you can sustain when you are watching day to day different atrocities, be it the aid, be it what happened to UNRWA. Every day is something. How can you sustain this? And what are you expecting the world to look like afterwards? After this. And now there's an invasion of Rafah. And we're sitting here debating what is right and what is wrong. And Hamas, this is bigger. This is older than Hamas. This is bigger. This is older than any political entity. This is a plight. This is the result of years of oppression. And I said this also on the show. They talk about, and especially in our culture, it's not even the blatant killing and theft. It's the disrespect. Watching your father get disrespected at the checkpoint. Watching your colleague suddenly get dragged away from his home. Watching as a soldier helps a settler come into your home and takes everything that you own and that you've worked with. And for the world to stand up and say, well, you ought to be quiet about it. How else are you going to resist this? If every single international entity is being used to actually weaponize and enable these atrocities, who's to stand up for me? And this is what's happening with the students is a microcosm of that. Who's standing up for what's happening? Who's standing up for the oppressed? The world is broken. And what is happening in Palestine is a representation of the continued oppression of the complete distrust between people and their leaders. This is not sustainable. And for people to come out and instead of listening to these protesters, instead of listening to these students and them dawning and it dawning on them, oh yes, we need to do something about it. Instead of them saying that, they discredit their own students. Of course, it's infuriating. Of course, it's going to push these students to continue.
Well, we have a clip of you on Piers Morgan. Let's take a look. So here's Piers Morgan with a gotcha asking you how Israel should have responded to October 7th, to the terrorist attack.
How should Israel have responded to that terror attack?
By ending the siege. By ending apartheid, by realizing that this is not a sustainable solution to keep oppressing a people. I'll tell you something interesting. There's blatant attacks, like I blatantly kill you. But there is something that we don't realize that hurts sometimes even more, the intangible, the disrespect, the checkpoints. One day at one of these checkpoints and the amount of disrespect these people have to go through, the fact that at one point in the West Bank, a settler can just walk into your home, waltz into your home, destroy your home, take it, and be backed by a soldier. The utter disrespect of having so much injustice. There was this one Palestinian who said, our heart breaks every day over 100 times. What on earth, how is this sustainable? This is the longest siege on any place in history.
Okay.
Well done.
These people absolutely have a right to resist. This is a supremacist mentality.
Rama, what have you seen from Egypt? Can you tell us about what you've observed there? You've been to the border, right?
Exactly. And this is what is insane. When has this occupation ever wanted peace? you know what they would do? First of all, they cut off aid. And then when they'd say finally they're going to open Rafah, they bomb the narrow passage in the area so that these big trucks full of aid can't even pass through. So even when you are to open, these trucks can't pass through. They also, some people don't realize the mental warfare they put people through.
Hey, Ram, I don't mean to interrupt you. Bryce and Aiden, who wanted to stay to overlap with you, they both have to go because they're at the encampment. So we're going to let them go, but then we'll keep talking.
Yeah. I just want to say thank you, Rama, for all that you've done and all that you continue to do. You've been a powerful voice for educating and motivating people. Invaluable, and keep it up.
Thank you, Bryce. It hasn't been feeling like that, honestly, not going to lie. I'm so upset.
No, you got this. You got this. Keep it up. You are changing lives, changing hearts, and mobilizing the new generation. So even if it doesn't feel like it. All right. Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
Honestly, Katie, it's what I'm basically telling you is I think the reason it's so hurtful because it really does make you realize at one point that you are talking with people who think that you are lesser than, and therefore, where can you go from there? And I think this was the problem all along. They expect Palestinians to take it. They expected Arabs to just take it, the theft, the disrespect, the continuous harassment. And for them to continue to own the narrative for so long has aided in their confidence and audacity and the continuation of their war crimes until it finally reached its pressure point, basically. You are seeing the result of people expecting you to be oppressed and be silent about it.
Well, Rama, this was really important, and I have so many more questions for you. But let's try to do this when you have a better connection.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I thought my connection was great, but I think it keeps going and coming.
Yeah. But anything you want to add about what you've seen? Because you've been to the border, right? You've been to Rafah?
Yes.
Can you tell us what you've seen?
Sure. I haven't been there for so long, but the one point that I was allowed to be there, I can tell you that it was occupation blocking and aid. I can tell you that 2 a.m., they're so evil and so Machiavellian. They're so evil that at one point, 2 a.m., they start bombing, and it's carpet bombing. So you hear one bomb go off after the other. And with each bomb, it's how many civilians are being slaughtered, how many lives are being shut down. And what's scary is that you listen to these bombings and you're unable to do anything about it, even though you're just 3 kilometers away. And I think this is exactly how the students are feeling now. They're watching a genocide live on their television, on their screens, and they're waiting for someone to do something about it. No one's doing something about it. So they've decided to be the resilient force that's actually going to stand up and say enough is enough. And though we're going back to that, the ridiculous conversation I was having with this man who claimed to be the son of a Hamas leader, who is the son of a Hamas leader, giving his Machiavellian monologues, you know, and it's just absolutely ridiculous being on the Mossad payroll and speaking in this manner, saying there's no such thing as a Palestinian, and yet saying that he's going to speak on behalf of the Palestinians, and then having this other host who is repeating the same questions you've heard 5 months ago, 40,000 Palestinian deaths later. And the question is, if these were 40,000 British dead, if these were 40,000 American, if these were 40,000 German, would the world still be reacting the same way it is right now? That's my question. And that's what hurts. When you realize the double standards, when you realize that Arab life is worth less. And this is why there's a continuation of the slaughter. You know, one last thing about the protests. There was this Jewish student who said something most interesting. He's like, yes, I fear for my life. Yes, I'm feeling insecure, but not because I'm Jewish, but because I'm protesting for Palestine and against oppression.
That's it, yeah. Well, Rama, thank you so much for what you do and keep doing it. And you're doing great. And I'm sorry if you're upset, but don't be upset because you're on the right side of history.
Thank you, Katie. I know. This is why it's so funny. Like after you have a show like that, you want to speak to a friend. So it's helpful.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. You definitely are, Katie. And I'm so proud of what you're doing. And really, really, you know, I have so much love for you. As you and Aaron, of course, but like really keep doing what you're doing. And we have that all each other. There's this community that has sprouted out of people who just want to do what's right. It's ridiculous. It's crazy. You're basically saying killing people is wrong. Oppressing them is wrong. Stop it. And they're calling you extremist and all sorts of names.
And hateful, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, we're all doing what we can. We all cry every day. And at the end of the day, there are no idols, there are no heroes. And this was something else that was said on the show that I was just so shocked that they were talking about. He was like, what are your leader? Who is your leader? I'm like, this is a grassroots movement. And this is why I reiterate, everyone who is speaking for Palestine has a different mindset, has a different ideology. But at the end of the day, it's ultimately about oppression is wrong. And yesterday, like the day before yesterday, were these Palestinian Christians who are so hurt because of the siege that is happening on the church, for example, a mother getting shot at and then her daughter getting shot at because she comes to help out her mother. This is not, they're trying so hard to make it a religion thing, but it is a human thing. It's about you. It's about me. It's a collective movement where people are saying this, where is this world going? Where is this? This world is broken and there has to be something that needs to be done now. Welcome to my TED Talk.
No, yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining. And we'll talk to you again soon. And you have a lot of love coming to you from the chat. And you're on the right side of history. So.
So are you. And so are all of us. And you know, power to the people. Really, really power to the people.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.